Paramedic here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. We make it easy for you to enhance your outdoor living space with the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block. Ready to take home today. Build a fire pit or retaining wall with our tumbled Belgian wall blocks. On sale now. Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. The closest that, like, Bernie Sanders will ever come to a median voter view is having this incoherent critique of oligarchy. But, like, I'm trying to ask the question of, like, does Bernie Sanders's critique make sense?
Hi, I'm Jerusalem.
I'm Matt.
And welcome to The Argument.
I want to talk today about the oligarchy. And specifically, I don't think the oligarchy is real.
I feel like this is all like a definitional morass. It's going to be like difficult to wade through. But like, what do you mean when you're saying oligarchy?
There's been a fighting oligarchy tour that has been going on for months, headlined by Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They have rallied with various candidates they're supporting. And, you know, so they have chosen to define their sort of factional project in terms of an oligarchy that they are combating. But beyond like that sect, I remember after the 2024 election, Amy Klobuchar, who's I think is normally like a very moderate and level-headed person, she like complained that a broligarchy of tech people was like coming to the Trump inauguration. And some of this goes back to, you know, like older ideas that have been kicking around political science literature. But there's some sense, right, shared perhaps by Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar, that like a small cabal of very wealthy people is like secretly running the country. And that, you know, like a top tier political concern is we need to stop them from doing that. And I just like, I don't think that's happening. I don't think that explains American politics at all.
There's a ton of rhetorical slippage in this entire conversation, but I think it's also just like par for the course for politics. And I just want to take like the like oligarchy as like a real thing steel man for a second, because I do genuinely feel
that'll be a better podcast. Yeah.
And but I mean like just actually like I have been as a political journalist in more political spaces with a lot of wealthy people, moving from being a person that was kind of just like in politics largely a private citizen, not working in that space, to work in that space. It is like genuinely extremely off-putting, like the way that like the private access that like very, very wealthy people get to politicians in a way that like regular people just do not have. Like it's just like not possible for like 99.9999% of normal people to ever get like sustained 30 minutes of attention from their elected officials. This is like obviously true. Like how would someone even divide their time? But like it's extremely frustrating because there's an ethos of democracy, which is around like obviously one person, one vote. But that's supposed to communicate that you have equal power, regardless of your position in society, over the democratic system. And like we accept some level of inequality here. Like obviously some people are going to care more about certain issues. They'll be involved more. You know, like if you don't vote, don't complain is I think a very normal thing that people feel. Like if you don't like engage in the political process at all, there's like a sense that you've just chosen to opt out. And that's fine. But the extent to which that is like visibly true in places like DC or New York is really, really frustrating. And when those sorts of things become visible to regular people for whom those are not obvious facts of life because they don't live in like, you know, large East Coast cities where these donor events go on, I think it's like completely reasonable to be like turned off by that.
Sure. I mean, but I do think it's important to try to understand like what is happening in specific ways. Now, it's definitely true that like politicians pay different amounts of attention to different people, and different people can get on their schedules in different kinds of ways. That being said, like, you know, if you want to attend a fundraiser with a politician and get some FaceTime with that person, the amount of money that you need to contribute to something like that is not like you don't need to be a billionaire.
Well, cool to be at one of these fundraisers where you get to see them in a room do their stump speech, and then you get to, like, they come down the line and say hello, and you get, like, 30 seconds, like, sure. But if you want 30 minutes of, like, a major presidential candidate's time, like, that's not true.
Well, I mean, I think it's a little different, right? I mean, like, what do you get? I mean, yeah. You know, major presidential candidates, et cetera. Is this because of donations at all?
So, like, I mean, there's, like, a great study from Friends of the Pod, Josh Kalla and David Brockman, about this very question. They're, like, looking into, like, whether it is the case that, like, donors do get better access to both candidates and senior elected officials. And, like, generally what they're doing is that they're, like, testing out, like, requests for meetings to candidates and to senior staff. And if the person is a donor, I think it's, like, 5 times as likely to get a senior staffer and, like, 3 times as likely to get FaceTime with the candidate yourself. Now, that's not, like, donors own this person, but that is, like, a level of difference that where, like, I think people would find that genuinely
absolutely
bad.
Absolutely. And I think, but I also think that people oftentimes misstate, like, how much influence does that actually give you? Who are the donors? What is the nature of the influence that is wielded that way? And also, what is the reasons for it? You know, because if you go to a country with a completely different campaign finance system, right, like, an executive at Lego has a tremendous amount of access to Danish politicians, right? Not because they make campaign contributions, but because, like, politicians care what the executives of the big companies in their country think. And also, like, they're correct to care about that, right? Like, it's a little icky, right? Now, if somebody was like, how come you'll take a meeting with the executive from Vestas, another Danish company, and, like, not with me? It's like, well, the answer is the CEO of Vestas is more important than you are. And it's like,
I think that, like, this is, I mean, we're going to get into this, which is just the actual material, like, impact of this different levels of, you know, FaceTime or influence that you have. But I think that, like, most people are not consequentialists. And, like, they're people who just have senses of what is, like, honorable behavior. And the idea that, you know, like, service worker comes to talk to her elected official and can't get a meeting, but Lego official, like, can. Like, I just want to, there is a broad, widespread feeling in the country that, like, this oligarchy feeling, or when you look at polls around, like, do a small number of people have control of your government, like, that people resonate with that seems to me a reflection of the fact that people have different moral intuitions here than maybe, you know, wonks like us.
Well, no. But I mean, I think it's important to, like, talk through the modalities of influence, because I think that people genuinely sort of misunderstand what's going on here. Because what I'm trying to say, like, in a world with no campaign contributions and no donor influence, business executives would still get privileged access to elected officials, right? And so, to an extent, what's happening, because I think what left-wing people, because there's the mass public and, like, their concerns, but there's this specific, like, left critique of oligarchy, right? And I think that lots of left-wing people think of the campaign finance system as diminishing the influence of their left-wing ideas and empowering rich business people. And one of the points that I'm just trying to make here is that, like, business people are influential in any kind of campaign finance system because of the real-world consequences of their role in the economy, right?
But I think it's what people are uncomfortable with. When you're talking about regular people who are reacting in polls, like, you look at polls and you ask people, like, hey, like, do you think that small numbers of people have control over government? And they largely say yes. I don't think they're thinking through the exact mechanism all the time. Like, maybe they will say Citizens United. But I think they recognize that there's, like, an inequality between their value to an elected official and the value of a business person, and they're uncomfortable with the widening like, it is literally true that a businessman can tell you, like, hey, I'm concerned about potentially having to lay some people off. These prices of my inputs are increasing, and it's becoming a problem for the viability of this corporation that is important for your local hometown. And, like, representative, you know, these are representatives of interests that are broader than their own individual, like, self-interest. So I think that's true, but I think that, like, it can be a feeling that's irrational when it gets, like, operationalized into policy choices. But the feeling itself, I think, is, like, not that unreasonable.
Like, I want to say, like, all the time, I'm complaining about the left's insane politics and their hideous slogans, and people hate them. This is not my critique here. Like, I agree. Like, the closest that, like, Bernie Sanders will ever come to a median voter view is having this incoherent critique of oligarchy. But, like, I'm trying to ask the question of, like, does Bernie Sanders's critique of the oligarchy make sense, right? And this is why I keep rolling back to the fact that with no campaign finance, the business executive still has a higher voice, right? Because Bernie, they're trying to say something specifically about wealthy individuals as distinct from, I think, like, business executives in their corporate role, right? Because, like, the main thing that is empowered by, like, rich people wielding their financial clout rather than people with a structural role in business, empowers left-wing ex-wives and, like, heirs and kids and things like that, right, who would not have clout. Like, nobody would care what Mackenzie Scott thinks if not for the fact that she's super-duper-duper rich. The CEO of Walmart, I'm sure, like, makes a decent living, but isn't actually a billionaire, right? Because it's not a founder-owned startup anymore. The Walton heirs are extremely rich, but the CEO of the company is just an influential person, right? In light of what it is he actually does. And I myself have, like, qualms about donor influence over things and, like, rail and complain about this and stuff like that. But, like, I think, like, a big thing that's happened in the Democratic Party is that Democratic Party donors have these, like, very left-wing views about climate change that they have imposed on people. Abortion rights donors have imposed a very rigid orthodoxy that, like, got Democrats away from safe, legal, and rare rhetoric. And, like, I think that's bad. The Argument is brought to you by Forkful. Eating well can be difficult when life gets busy. Finding time for meal planning and cooking is a challenge. Most meal kits promise convenience, but they require prep and cleanup. Meal services can use things that are harmful to your body. Takeout often sacrifices quality ingredients and tastes. So Forkful offers meals that prioritize flavor, function, and health. No seed oils, fresh cooked, never frozen, ready-to-eat meals made with high-quality premium proteins. We're talking grass-fed bison, wild-caught salmon, fresh vegetables. They got menus that fit your lifestyle. If you need gluten-free, if you need dairy-free, if you need plant-based, they've got that, as well as a standard menu. It doesn't need to be complicated to eat well. You get fully prepared, deliciously healthy meals with no prep, no cooking, no cleanup, just clean flavors ready in under 3 minutes. It'll be delivered to your door within 24 to 48 hours of ordering. So how do you get this? You can explore our plans and menu of fresh, ready-to-eat meals at ForkfulMeals.com and use code ARGUMENT to get 50% off your first order. That's ForkfulMeals.com/argument and use promo code ARGUMENT for 50% off. Thanks to Forkful for sponsoring this episode.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The places where I depart from the oligarchy people is that they seem to have, I guess the term I used earlier is rhetorical slippage here. Like, sometimes there's, like, a small cabal of billionaires that's in charge. But then they're
like
citing,
an oligarchy.
Yeah, like, literally an oligarchy. But then sometimes it's like the top 10%, which includes people who are, like, a two-income professional household in the suburbs. But then it's like, well, but none of these people actually believes we should tax anyone earning less than $400,000. So we're not talking about those people. So there comes, I think the problem here is that they want to have it, like, every which way without really defining what they're talking about. But you, as you just said, have had critiques about the influence of, like, climate donors or abortion donors, et cetera. So, like, what is the mechanism by which those people have outsized influence?
I mean, yes, it's wealth, right? Like, it's bad when people wield their influence in bad ways. And I sympathize with that. But, I mean, again, the concept of an oligarchy, it seems to me, right, it posits a kind of a consolidated, you know, like, rich guy.
It's a conspiratorial. Yeah, yeah.
Oligarch class, right? And you, in fact, see, like, a very polarized set of influential political donors, mm-hmm. right? Like, there isn't an oligarchy, quote unquote. Or, you know, you take like a true mega billionaire whose political influence, I think, has been destructive over the years, is Mark Zuckerberg, who is super duper duper rich. But he, the main thing that he, political intervention that he tried to make was through FWD.us, and he like tried to get Democrats to adopt more left-wing views on immigration and criminal justice issues. And I think that played a big role actually in bringing Trump back to power. Then after Trump won in 2024, like Zuckerberg like put on a gold chain and went on Joe Rogan and complained about like Joe Biden being woke and said we needed more masculine energy. So he like went into the realm of like evil right-wing billionaire.
That's a broligarch.
For progressive market. Right. Yes, yes, yes. But I mean, like the main political intervention he made was a left-wing political intervention that was done.
But I want to understand this better, because your view is that like it's the wealth of these climate and abortion donors. But I think that like people will understand that differently than what I think you're actually saying, because it's not, oh, they're literally buying a politician. It's that they are funding groups that will engage in the democratic process to make their issues more salient, to put out white papers saying that their ideas are correct, to draft bill language, to lobby on the Hill. Like, what you're talking about is billionaires are able to have outsized influence on democratic discourse because they can just produce more discourse.
Yeah, they can do that. I mean, I remember something that opened my eyes that had never really occurred to me. This was naive, but, you know, a long time ago, I worked at Center for American Progress, and I didn't like really have like a policy role there, but I was in a meeting with some people who did, and we were talking about, I forget what we were talking about actually, but I said like, we should do like a program that's about how to make like bus networks better. Because that's like a topic that I'm interested in. I forget what it would, maybe I was saying this would be good for climate or would be good for poor people. I don't know, whatever it is. And somebody said like, well, if you can find somebody who would fund that, like we would love to do that. And it wasn't, you know, again, this wasn't like evil Center for American Progress donors were preventing us from doing like an improved bus network thing. It's just literally like you can't do anything at a nonprofit unless somebody will give you money to do it. And I'm like, I'm not a fundraiser. I'm not a tactical person. I'm not like really interested in grant organizing. Maybe if I'd like put my mind to it, I could have found somebody to fund this. But like, it was just, the reality is that what gets worked on is what gets funded. And rich people wield a lot of influence through that, but so do like the people who control grant-making foundations, some of which have a living donor, but many of which have dead donors, right? So like part of, I don't like the term oligarchy, but like it is true that there is inequality in American society and that some of this manifests in unequal political influence. But like the program officers at the Rockefeller Foundation are not billionaires, and their power will not be curbed by like taxing the rich, but they wield wildly disproportionate power over American politics because they control these pools of philanthropical money. And like, we could say like that's good, that's bad, but it's like if you want to have an accurate picture of what does unequal political voice look like in the United States, you just need a much richer understanding of it than to just say like, well, Steve Ballmer has a lot of money. Because like Steve Ballmer does have a lot of money, but as far as I know, doesn't try to wield political influence with it at all. Lots of people who have much smaller fortunes than him, but like care more about political issues, wield much more influence. So like one really important axis of unequal political influence in the United States is how much do you care?
Yeah.
Right. And in a lot of ways, that's the biggest one. Right. Like the people who care about politics tend to have relatively extreme opinions. And that has like an unhealthy impact on society. But also, I don't know how to like make people give a damn.
I think that like to contrast this to the normal view, because the normal view, this is the view that's like, I think, espoused by Sanders, espoused by other people, is that Citizens United and like the other campaign finance Supreme yeah. Court decisions had a direct impact on the ability for wealthy people to control politics. And like some parts of this that are like of the story that are like straightforwardly true. Citizens United, but also, you know, like Speech Now and McCutcheon, like all of these make it much easier to give tons of money and like uncap it and also let interest groups spend on their own. So if you look at Open Secrets, super PAC spending went from $62.6 million in 2010 to over $4.1 billion in 2024. Dark money contributions jump from $359 million in 2012 to $1.4 billion in 2024. So again, like, that's a lot. And also, the money is also concentrated. So the top 100 individual donors go from 1.5% of all federal election spending in 2008 to like the 15% range in 2024. So it is like literally true that this, there were Supreme Court decisions that changed our campaign finance system. As a result of that, you saw a concentrated amount of spending on elections, so way more spending. But like, it feels like people take that to be like, okay, well, like obviously then the impact here is like very, very clear. I mean, the best study I've read about this is one that looked at the places where Citizens United states had their own bans on corporate union slash union spending. And so you could like contrast states that did do that before Citizens United versus ones that didn't. And what they find basically is like in states that had strong union support, there's like not really much impact because unions also are now able to spend a ton of money to counteract Republican spending. But in places that didn't, Republicans gain like a 3 to 4 point vote share and a 5 point jump in seat share on average. And in states like Texas and Mississippi, Idaho and the Carolinas, which are very low union business heavy states, up to 12 points. But then in places like California, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, basically nothing happens. Because again, high union. And I remember when I was an intern at Emily's List, I'm like now old. So I guess it was like 2015 or something like that. You know, someone at Emily's List Hype was like, oh, like this is a controversial opinion publicly. But like, to be honest, like Citizens United was like really good for Democrats, too. We have tons of people that are spending money for us and for our causes. So it's just like,
I mean,
it just depends on what state you're in. Right. Do you have the counterbalancing effect?
I'm pretty dubious of that study. I don't know. Like, college professors in America are like on one about labor unions and like published nonsense about this all
but
the time.
But I mean, it seems true that labor unions did spend tons of money.
I mean, labor unions spent money, but like Citizens United came down, I think, in 2010, right, in Obama's first term. And there was this immediate concern by Democrats that they were going to get buried in money by Republicans. And in 2012, they did get outspent by Republicans. But
famously, in 2012, Democrats still won.
But Obama won in 2012. What happened next is that Donald Trump entered the Republican Party. And Donald Trump came to the Republicans with a proposition that Republican Party donors hated, right? Like, Republican Party donors spent all this money on Mitt Romney. They failed. Mm-hmm. And then they like cooked up the infamous RNC autopsy report where they were like, what we've got to do is move to the center on immigration. And then Trump was like, fuck you. Let's not move to the center on immigration. Let's move to the center on Medicare and Social Security. He got outspent by like a bajillion to one in the Republican primary, won by huge margins. Then he ran against Hillary Clinton, who outspent him by huge sums of money. And then he won. Anyway, he was outspent. And then we entered this Trump era in which Democrats were constantly outspending Republicans, right? In 2018, in 2020, in 2022, in 2024, the margin was not as big as it had been earlier, but Democrats outspent Trump. Now it looks like it's flipping, right? That like Trump has actually reconsolidated conservative donors behind him, and Republicans are probably going to outspend Democrats in the upcoming midterms. But like, the whole basic story of Trump era politics was like donors not getting their
way. I mean, we're taping this like right after a bunch of primaries just happened, and like, I like the thing exactly what you're saying right now is what makes me so frustrated by oligarchy discourse, because there's like never any kind of like, huh, like look at all these times that these rich people fail. Like, we just saw Matt Mahan, who was like a tech-backed California governor candidate who I thought was very good. Very poor showing despite a bunch of spending on him. Shoykat Chakrabarty in San Francisco lost to, Scott Wiener despite self-funding and spending millions and millions of dollars. Eric Jones, another self-funder from the tech community, he's trailing outside the top two in like in another Bay Area race. There's also, Ethan Agarwal, a tech entrepreneur who people thought was going to go after Ro Khanna, also a total non-factor.
But I think actually of these California primaries, the biggest one that just raises like conceptual questions about the oligarchy is Tom Steyer. Yeah. Because not only did Tom Steyer spend a ton of money and lose to Javier Becerra, but like Steyer ran his campaign embracing the oligarchy narrative.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like the fact that Sicott lost in a way, or some of these other people, it's like, well, who knows, right? Because like maybe the oligarchy was behind Scott Wiener after all.
Now we're getting spicy.
I mean, who knows, right? But Steyer got, you know, he hired the Fight Agency, which mm-hmm. is like the premier makers of like populist ads. And he ran all these things about how the evil Javier Becerra was like being propped up by PSG&E and McDonald's and Chevron and all this stuff. And that like he, Tom Steyer, was the pure of heart candidate who wasn't taking corporate money. So we appear to be pivoting the argument to like the way to fight oligarchy is for like egomaniacal billionaires to launch self-funded campaigns. He then outspent his opponent by a huge amount. He had the anti-oligarchy message, but you know, like people power, which is just to say like middle-aged Latino voters who like Nancy Pelosi, just like put Becerra over the top, then yeah, Mahan is this other thing where like I would have voted for Matt Mahan. Like I thought his ideas were just correct. But also he initially launched with like rich guy backing. And I don't know, like I think like the voters of California, they just disagreed with like our shared critique of what's happening there.
But I think that like this is specifically this idea that these rich people losing doesn't tell you anything about this like broader oligarchy message is something that I find very frustrating, because like while I'm more sympathetic than you to like the problems of, you know, wealthy influence in politics, the problems that I often identify are things like in I think we share this actually is in housing or in places where there's low salience of the Democratic focus, right? Like places like land use regulations or tiny regulations that have like outsized impact on specific industries at the state level, even at the federal level. Like these are places where you see the outsized impact of specific interest groups. Sometimes that's like, again, like that's reasonable. Like you do want someone who's in the chemical manufacturing industry to have input on like what's going to happen when they're regulating various chemicals, because they often have subject matter expertise that's helpful. You want independent people as well, but it is useful to hear from like industry people on these things.
But that's a hot take.
But that's,
you know, like
what is a hot take?
Well, because I mean,
I think like industry capture.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a lot of concern about like revolving door and you know too many private sector people, and I think it's like a genuinely hard question, right? Because you don't want the Treasury Department to be just 100% run by people who come out of the financial services industry and are just sort of like talking their own books.
Yeah.
But you also don't want, I think, like you want people who...
You want no expertise.
Well, right. But I mean, it's not just you don't want no expertise, but like you don't want all of the expertise to be purely academic. Like interfacing with the business community is a legitimate part of the regulatory function. Also, the vast majority of the people who can do management, like work in the private sector where that's value, you know, and if you've ever worked in nonprofits, academia, it's like they're legendarily poorly managed because, you know, because there's the opposite of a wage premium to work in these roles, right? Like you accept lower pay in order to be achieving like self-actualization. But then that means that people want to do like the public facing interesting work. Right. Like, whereas like Walmart will just pay somebody to be a mid-level logistics manager and do a good job because they're making money. Right. So I think like you started with like people have unequal political influence and that gives people qualms. And I agree that like both of those things are true, but we end up in a worse like I think this is I think the populist rhetoric about this. Mm-hmm. You know, it reflects real concerns that people have, but it also like validates it back to them. To have like a United States senator telling the voters that like that like billionaires run this town. When it's like actually much more
complicated, it's because the populace don't have the courage of my convictions, I guess. Because what they should be saying is, you're right, there is a cabal of people that is reducing your ability to live better lives. They're called the homeowners of America, who are blocking new housing and new construction. Unfortunately, 80 million people are homeowners, and that
but
would
even
be extremely...
the homeowners, right? I mean, I think when YIMBYism was new, I think that a lot of us toiling in the trenches, you know, really wanted to have like materialist explanations of things, because this kind of stuff is like really in the ether.
Yeah.
And so it was like, ah, like the homeowners, they're blocking the new housing. And William Fishel, who did a lot of the foundational work on this, he had his home voter hypothesis, right? And it's like, well, people are going to exclude apartment buildings in order to like prop up their home values. And I think as, like YIMBY politics has gotten more advanced and we've gotten more academic research on this specific topic, it's actually really complicated, that view of like the self-interested homeowner blocking construction.
I definitely think it used to be overstated, but it still is true that homeowners in, especially if we're talking about high opportunity suburbs where you would want to have more class integration, they are like opposed to like apartment buildings. And and you're right, part of that doesn't have to do with literally property values, but I think it has to do, and again, we're getting a little far afield here because it's just mine and Matt's bailiwick, but I actually just do think that, like, you know, a politics that was focused on you know, we want to expand the social welfare state and there needs to be greater taxation of wealthy people, and you know what I mean, like, there's like, I think it is not the case that you could not have populist language focused on like good policies.
Sure. But I mean, again, I think if you, you know, if you read Neighborhood Defenders, right, one thing that's striking there is that, so this is a book, Catherine Eisenstein and
Einstein, Matthew Glick, and then one more that we're both forgetting.
Okay, well, that's a tough one. You know, this is about the people in New England, especially, who like rally together to block new housing. And, you know, one of the striking things about it is like they're genuinely quite idealistic, you know, in their motives, but also that the institutional mechanism through which this functions is very inegalitarian, but it's the inequality of like who bothers to show up.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, with any kind of...
Which is in part material.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's in part material, but it's in part, I mean, institutional mechanisms that were created in order to solve the alleged problem of like city officials all being in the pockets of developers. Mm-hmm. We created this other situation where city officials are in the pockets of
big community.
Like, well, just like the most neurotic people who happen to be among their constituents, right? And like, I remember, I was so struck. I wanted to put solar panels on the roof of my my house in DC, and this required a waiver from the Historic Preservation Review Board, and that I was told by the solar company would be easier to get if I got an endorsement from my advisory neighborhood commission. So I had to like get on the schedule of the ANC, and then I couldn't make it next month because I was traveling for work, so it was like another month and I had to go. I had to sit through the whole meeting, and at the meeting you have various people and they're petitioning for zoning variances. This ANC, like the actual members on it, they seem super reasonable, and they were just giving everybody their variances. But like the seven most insane people who live in the neighborhood were showing up to this meeting to be like, well, what if we made them bay windows? And then the developers would be like, sure, you know, we can do that. And it's like, what is this, right? Like, why are we doing this? And I mean, we can call that oligarchy too, I guess, if we want. But it strikes me as downstream of like delegitimizing the formal political process because of the sense that the formal political process is like secretly corrupted. And
well,
we've like invented something worse.
It's true that there was like real industry capture of, and which I mean happens even now, like especially if you look at like state and local, if you look at state and local politics, like capture by both interest groups and also business interests is like happens all the time. Like the to level which I think that, like, there's functionally, like, not local democracy in most of this country. It's just, like, run by interest groups and, like, nobody really votes. I think it was incorrect, obviously, to decide that the response to the industry capture, particularly the federal government, which, again, was actually happening, was to say, like, okay, well, we just need to create, a bulwark against industry capture. That's a different way of capturing the government. What you really want is to, like, shore up the ability of elected officials to make these decisions and trust that, like, those people are elected. But that doesn't actually respond to the problem of low salience things. Like, I think on high salience issues, things like healthcare, big economic policy, immigration, whatever, when things become very salient, you just, like, see politicians go, like, well, like, this is, I'm not going to lose my election over this. Yeah, like, yeah. I've got to move, right? But most issues aren't like that, sure. Even if they end up impacting high salience issues eventually. And so I don't actually think, like, anyone has a response to this. Like, how do you actually solve the problem of, like, low salience issues will never be, like, that democratically checked by the public?
Yeah, but, I mean, again, I think back to the, you know, the fighting oligarchy tour, right? Yeah. You know, one, like, real industry capture example is regulation of dental hygienists, right? Where the scope of practice for dental hygienists varies a lot from state to state. In places where a hygienist is allowed to set up her own office and clean people's teeth on her own, people are in better dental health because it is cheaper than when they need to be supervised by a dentist. And, like, a narrow cabal of evil dentists controls the state legislature in most states because people don't, as you say, like, people just don't care enough about this, right? But does that insight, like, align with an AOC anti-oligarchy rally? Because to me, it cuts against what she's saying. That, like, we have all these dysfunctions in the political system, and they relate to, like, interest groups and stuff that's bad. But, like, dentists aren't billionaires. They're just kind of prominent local business people. And the reason they're able to capture this is because people, like, don't focus on the issue. But, like, Bernie Sanders and AOC could focus on poor people's lack of access to dentistry services, but they choose to focus on, like, their own particular narratives about these things. And it's, like, occluding from people, like, what's actually going on in American political economy.
I think that, like, this is actually useful to go back to the original research that was
talking about Page and Gillens.
Yeah, Gillens and Page. I've never heard someone give Page's due first, but so that's
well,
nice.
So I'm very concerned about the issue of alphabetical order discrimination, which is something that I have never been able to get, you know, donors
anyone to care about.
And Mark Zuckerberg, notwithstanding my concerns about forward.us, I think that you and I, you know, Z and Y, let's work on this.
I always liked having, like, kind of early in the alphabet, but not too early, because you never get picked first for anything, which is, like, good, so that, you know,
it's
projects
tough
later. But no, I'm not Y. But yeah, so Gillens and Page, I mean, Sanders literally cites this in a hearing in 2014. Robert Reich, who is one of the big kind of economic populist leaders, was Department of Labor Secretary under Bill Clinton, and, like, has become, like, a very...
He makes a lot of videos.
He's, like, a very prominent voice in the left populist ecosystem. And they really rest a lot on this one study, which basically was trying to look at whose opinions independently predict what actually happens in policy. So you can look at, like, middle-class people, upper-class people, business groups, different interest groups, like, lobbying groups. Like, when you look at public opinion, like, does what they want actually happen? And they find something that ends up becoming, like, a really hot-button issue. They find that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impact on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence. And I'm quoting what Sanders actually said in that 2014 hearing. This paper gets, like, critiqued quite heavily. I mean, I think, like, even if you were to buy that everything was fine with this paper, to be, like, quite literal about what they're measuring, they're only looking at the 90th percentile of Americans, which is about 146,000 household income at the time. So, like, if we were saying, like, yes, these people have way more influence, that's not oligarchy. You're just saying that, like, richer people in America have more influence. But the broader problem with the paper is that when other people, like, replicated with the exact same data their findings, they see, like, A, there's, like, correlation between the middle and upper classes on, like, most issues, like 90% of cases. And then when you isolate only the cases where those two groups disagree, rich people win only 53% of the time, which is basically a coin flip. So I think it's like important here because, like, I mean, they don't really talk about this as much. I don't hear Sanders on an oligarchy tour citing Gillens and Page or whatever. But the, like, slippage from there is this study that says people in the top 10% have outsized impact on our politics to actually there's a cabal of billionaires and millionaires. And now actually, no, there's just a handful of billionaires and they're tech billionaires. And those are the people that are the main problem. I mean, even in the Steyer example, like you saw a lot of left-wing people really defending Steyer and saying like, well, Becerra is controlled by the billionaires, even though Steyer is a billionaire. And like, I just think people need to be like more straightforward here. Like they think like they're actually upset because they have policy differences. Like what they're upset about is that they have these specific policy views and they're trying to attach it to this oligarchy frame. But like the actual substance of what they're talking about doesn't even support the underlying research doesn't even support what they're saying.
Well, and I think, you know, this is really important, right, in the Gillens and Page, A, that the original point they were making was about the disproportionate political influence of what I guess you would characterize as the mass affluent, right? Like they're talking about a large group of people who are just richer than the average person, which is just a very different phenomenon from the idea that billionaires, right? And even like Bernie Sanders in his 2016 campaign used to talk about billionaires and millionaires, mm-hmm. and then he dropped the millionaires, right?
Inflation,
and,
man.
And there were way more millionaires than billionaires.
Yeah.
And a billion is a much larger number than a million. I mean, one of the wisest things I ever heard about politics is that all numbers that end in illions sound the same to people.
Yeah.
But this is like a really big difference between saying that the aggregate political influence of everyone who is wealthy enough to be a homeowner in like a coastal city, mm-hmm. you know, it like outweighs the influence of poor people, and the idea that like the 400 people on the Forbes 400 list.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, influence, right? This is radically different. And then what they found, again, when you, it's like actually like a modest difference in influence. A really good book that I read a long time ago is called Lobbying and Policy Change, Who Wins, Who Loses, and Why by Frank Baumgartner and a bunch of co-authors. And like the really important finding of this book is that in the vast majority of cases, whichever side is lobbying for policy change loses, right? That like the number one thing about the American system of government is that it is hard to change the status quo.
Yeah.
Right. And it is just not the case that the side that has more money wins the fight. Now they look at it and it's, you know, it's as you would think, right? A lobbying campaign that has a gajillion dollars behind it is somewhat more likely to win than one that has $1 million behind it. If you have no dollars, I mean, this is back to my bus map reform idea. Like you need more than $0 or else like literally nothing will happen, mm-hmm. right? You have to find somebody with money to back you or there's absolutely no chance of anything happening. But like, sides that get outspent in lobbying domains, like, lose all the time, right? Because mm-hmm. you're just defending the status quo. And if you think about the United States as a country that has a lot of status quo bias, I think that just gets you so much closer to the truth about like why it's hard to achieve utopia than if you think of it as a country that is controlled by billionaires, you know? And there's like a really big difference between those diagnoses, even though it's true in both cases that like if a billionaire like happens to get jazzed up about my dental hygienist reform, like that does meaningfully increase the odds of it happening, right? Because right now nobody's doing it. Like this is just like a take that people write sometimes. So like the wealthy like wield more influence, but if Bill Gates decided to go all in on dental hygienist scope of practice, like he'd still probably lose. That's the reality of America.
I mean, I really do think that like largely what this all comes down to is that people underrate small d democracy. That like we literally eat no matter all the things that Trump is doing, Republicans have done to undermine small d democratic processes. You still do need to win more votes than the other guy to like win your election, which like is a massive check. I mean, like right now we just saw Republicans really turn on Trump when it comes to the $1.8 billion slush fund he was supposed to. He was going to try and institute, which was basically a fund that he was going to like reward political opponents. It was like January 6th people for quote unquote unfair prosecution. And, you know, Republicans were like, OK, like quite a bad look. Corruption looks really bad. Corruption is one of the things that, like, I mean, in our argument polling, but also everywhere, like, is popping as a really big concern. I mean, it's something that John Ossoff talks about all the time on the campaign trail.
And also, like, people are mad about gas prices in Iran. Right.
They so are. Just,
Republicans yes. are feeling nervous.
They're feeling nervous. But, like, I think corruption in particular is something that is popularly understood as being a bad part of the Trump administration. And as a result, I mean, like, they turned, I mean, and again, like, they turned on him, and he's not going to do this. And the thing that frustrates me the most about, like, the left populist worldview is that they're like, there's no updating when this kind of thing happens. Like, okay, like, what does it actually tell you then about the impact of wealthy people vis-a-vis the Democratic public? But I think the part where I still feel like, Matt, that you're not giving, like, fair shake to is that even though I agree with you that the mechanism by which most of the policy influence has had is that these billionaires are largely funding interest groups, activists, they're funding academic research institutions, et cetera, to push ideas that they already agree with. And like, I don't even think this is like bought. Like, this is like they already agree with people. So they give those people money so those people can continue doing what they're doing.
Right.
Even
I mean,
more
it's the bus reform again.
Exactly.
Right? It's like everyone who cares about policy has more than one thing that they think.
Yeah, like the right. investors in the argument agree with me on a lot of things. Like, they did not pay me to agree with
yeah,
them.
Yeah, yeah,
they
right.
paid me because I, or like, right. they invested because they agree with me.
People try to find funding for
exactly.
the work that they want to do. And if they can find someone who agrees with them,
yeah.
they get money and they go work on that.
The thing that concerns me is that, like, fundamentally underlying liberal democracy is this idea of, like, public reasoning. That, like, in public, we're all getting together, we're, like, arguing over different things and, like, not that, like, there's a marketplace of ideas that will always win out with the best idea, but there is, like, some ability for people to understand things together. So Medicare for All is said for the first time, and, like, people don't know what that means. You have to have a process by which people hear individuals they trust or distrust talking about it. There's debate over the costs or benefits of it. This is partially why, this process is partially why, like, you know, Medicare for All might pull really well, but, hey, Medicare for All, but your taxes have to go up doesn't pull well. Like, this is all a part of this, like, broader, like, discussion that has to happen in order for liberal democracy to actually work. And I do think it's a problem that, like, the discursive processes are, like, captured. And the most obvious example of this is Elon Musk, right? Like, when you look at Twitter, pre-Elon, post-Elon, I mean, it is literally, I think, shifted the discourse of tons of people who are politically powerful in a rightward direction. There's, like, trivial examples of this, which is that, like, people are, like, more comfortable, like, saying things that are considered, like, quote unquote, not woke or whatever. But, like, also just, like, the, like, shifted the Overton window of conversation to the right on various issues, like the types of things that are now, like, normal to say about trans issues, about immigration, about the Biden administration, about people, like, it is just literally more right wing. And when you talk to elected officials or, you know, people who work on the Hill or in Washington, D.C., they feel that shift very directly because that is the place where they get tons of information. Now, of course, like, there's, like, backlash to this, like, you when you're exposed to, like, insane right wing views, it also
yeah.
like makes you like, OK, these people are a little crazy. But this one man's decision to, like, purchase literally a specific town square had, like, massive outsized impact, even though he didn't do anything literally undemocratic.
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree. This is, like, a feature of life. But here's my counter.
I mean, I think that's a little bit.
No. But I mean, my, you know, so go way, way, way back to, you know, early Vox days. And Thomas Piketty's book is out and people are reading it. And Ezra Klein, you know, more recently known for Abundance, he writes a piece that's called The Doom Loop of Oligarchy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, you know, a core concern, a real idea, right? Not just a loose characterization that's in here, which is that because rich people have excess political influence, that there is an independent, like, economic policy reason
mm-hmm.
to want to check the size of their fortunes, right? So, you know, I mean, Ezra's always, like, center-left guy, Democrat, me too. Like, I support progressive taxation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But also in a Rawlsian sense, right? I think there's, like, a level of egalitarianism in which you're actually making people worse off.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, and, like, that's not good. You want a growing economy with, like, you know, a rising tide, blah, 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 blah. And so there's this question of, like, is there this independent reason found in the political science papers or in Thomas Piketty or something to say that we should, like, go beyond the optimal bend point on the curve? And I think that, you know, it's not that it's untrue that very rich people can exert disproportionate political influence. But I think that before you make economic policy choices, deliberately make economic policy choices that make society poorer, you should have, like, a really good reason for that. Like, a really clear argument about, like, why this is important, about why curbing specifically the power of the ultra wealthy is going to get to a better situation. And I just don't think we're there. Like, I don't think Piketty was there. I don't think Gillen's and Page's research support that specific conclusion. I don't think Bernie's rhetoric about this is, like, super clear as to what he's even talking about, that he could switch from millionaires to billionaires so rapidly. The Elon Musk buying Twitter thing is, like, really fascinating. A.G. Sulzberger also exerts wildly disproportionate influence
over New York Times.
Yeah. New York Times. The Sulzberger family is more affluent than the average Americans, but, like, they're not on the Forbes 400 list. They're just, like, not that rich. Because New York Times, you know, Elon Musk's fortune comes from Tesla, and he just bought Twitter, right? The Sulzberger's money just is the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Their influence is that the New York Times is incredibly influential. And the reason the New York Times is so influential has to do with, like, it was founded, you know, over 100 years ago, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's, like, a true thing about America that what A.G. Sulzberger thinks about politics matters, like, more than what I think or what you think. Mm-hmm. And what you and I think matters more than what the average person thinks, because there's just people differ in how large of a microphone they have. And I just don't see, like, a solution to that that's compatible with freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what do we, you can't own a newspaper. Everyone's podcast has to have an equal audience. Like, I have too many Twitter followers because I was an early adopter. What are we doing?
I mean, I do think that, like, the original sin of so much of this discourse is an obsession with inequality, qua inequality, rather than, okay, there's inequality that we're uncomfortable with, but, like, there's certain kinds of it that have material impacts that we find unreasonable or that, like, stem from something unjust. So, like, an inequality that is born of, you know, sexism or, you know, treatment of someone unfairly based on an immutable characteristic, like, we can have a problem with that because, like, that underlying what we're saying is that there is, like, an meritocratic system that has been distorted as a result of, you know, bigotry or unfair treatment or whatever. And then there's a second way of caring, which is, like, okay, there's, like, inequality, and that's, like, really bad because we think it's harmful when there are lots of children who are poor and don't have food, and that's, like, a broadly shared view. But that actually doesn't have to do that much with inequality. Like, I agree, like, the juxtaposition, like, I have felt this when I'm doing reporting on homelessness in, like, very wealthy, like, cities. Like, when you, like, walk by, like, $10 million homes, and then, like, you see someone, like, literally living on the street. Like, that is a very, like, visceral moment, and it's very difficult to, like, witness that and not feel, like, a level of injustice. But, like, then you have to go, like, okay, now how would I resolve this problem, right? And, like, there's, like, such an instinct to just, like, sit in that emotion and go, like, well, there are the oppressors and the oppressed, and therefore, in order to help the oppressed, we just need to, like, hit the oppressors. And, like, those people are just the people who are, seem like they're benefiting from the system or, like, are clearly But the important thing here is that, like, I think it's good that people have the instinct to view inequality and see something and feel that. But then, like, the value of all of these interest groups and these people who have the time to, like, think through the politics and the policy of this is, like, well, how would I actually help this homeless person? Because would it help them to do a wealth tax? Does that actually solve homelessness in, like, the Bay Area to, like, do a wealth tax? Like, does it actually resolve this problem that I have about, like, widespread child poverty or hunger? Like, and then that's what's so frustrating, is, like, that doesn't actually do anything to solve the thing that you originally said you're upset about.
Yes. No, I mean, I agree. And this is, you know, I mean, again, with the dentists,
yeah.
I think it's true.
You love this dentist thing.
No, I mean, it's, you know, factually, one reason why the dentists will win these lobbying battles is that dentists are relatively affluent.
Yeah.
But the reason to reform scope of practice is just it's a good idea.
Yes.
It's not like, well, we need to, like, break the power of the dentists in order to have the downstream. Because I don't think that you can change the fact that across a number of different dimensions, just like some people are better situated to wield political influence than others, and some of those people wield it badly. I mean, it's like an aspect of the human condition that I think, you know, we need to reconcile
ourselves to. Inequality is, or like difference is an aspect of the human condition that lots of people are uncomfortable with.
Right. But I mean, not just that, but just that, you know, there's a lot of issues. They can't all be salient simultaneously. Most people don't care that much about democracy. If you try to create participatory institutions where it's like, well, we're going to ask the community. Mm-hmm. But it's like the community mostly won't show up, right? So it's like you can't, you know, you have to think about, like, are we making things better or worse? And on a lot of issues that, like, progressive-minded people care about, like immigration, like climate, just like don't have this class dimension. Like people's views differ. Like people have different, I don't know how to put it. You know, it's like I grew up in New York. I've always lived in like big, diverse, cosmopolitan cities. I go to Kerr County, Texas, and I'm like, how come there's no Indian restaurants here? Like this sucks. but lots of other people like don't like immigrants. You know, and like that has a very large influence on American politics.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, that is a perfect segue to
peer review. What are we talking about?
Which is our segment where we talk about a new or just interesting white paper. We have one today about the impact of immigration on mortality among the elderly. So basically, they're just trying to figure out, like, does more immigration benefit old people, 65 plus, those on Medicare? And they find that a 25% increase in the steady state flow of immigrants to the U.S. results in 5,000 fewer deaths nationwide. And they look at, like, nursing homes as a key mechanism driving this result. Now, I think, well, like, the paper itself, really good at isolating the impact of immigration itself, because like you wouldn't want to measure accidentally like, okay, there are really immigrant heavy cities and those cities have more longevity for, seniors by factor of something that's unrelated to the immigrants. And so they're able to isolate this. And they also want to isolate the fact that like older people might move towards immigrant-rich areas because there's, like, more care for them in those places.
The idea here is that a lot of immigrants work in, like, home health aid type jobs.
And they look at specifically, like, Filipinos are and, like, other – they try to weight the immigrant populations based on, like, how likely they are to actually work in healthcare. Like, Filipinos are way more likely than Mexicans to work in elder care. And, you know, obviously, like, this catches my eye in particular because – elderly Americans are less likely than younger Americans to support immigration. But it seems to me like, you know, you wrote an article for The Argument, a few months back about that touched on the idea that immigration, the case for immigration kind of goes down in a world where AI can do so many of the jobs and can actually be the increase in labor, quote unquote, that immigrants usually provide. But I think it doesn't actually ring true specifically for care, which is an area where I think humans are going to have a really hard time turning that over to AI. Like aspects of that, sure, like monitoring, make sure a baby's still breathing, like whatever. But like people want a human being taking care of their grandpa and like playing chess with him. Not like they don't want him just like playing Magnus Carlsen on like chess.com constantly. You're shrugging for our auditory listeners, but I think that I would win out in this case that like most people do want human beings taking care of their elderly family members. And I think as a result, like you have this weird situation where like people who benefit, I think, maybe the most from immigration are often like the least supportive of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just to give a sense of the scale here, though, I mean, a 25% increase in the steady state flow of immigrants to the U.S., that's like hundreds of thousands of people, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about a, a large increase.
Yes, but like to be clear, like they're measuring deaths. You have to think about like the rest of the healthcare impacts, like that they don't measure. So it's like deaths is like the one that's easiest to actually capture, but you should presume that like they're benefiting them on all these other measures of longevity or health.
I mean, I'm sure. I just, you know, I think it is understandable that this is primarily an issue where like people who like immigration will want to like put it in their binder of like these are good arguments in favor of immigration.
Correct.
Rather than something that's going to change the minds of people who feel that high levels of immigration are destroying society.
I think that you're correct that like for the people who are motivated by this idea that like, you know, there is a cultural shift in the country as a result of immigration they're not comfortable with, this is like not persuasive. But I think like most people are like not super ideological. Like they have discomforts in some directions, but they're also like America's land of immigrants. Like they're just like,
absolutely. Look, I'm not trying to totally dismiss it. I just mean there's some things, you know, that relate to like the air pollution caused by tires disintegrating on the highway,
mm-hmm.
where I really feel like if I could just convince people that this study is true,
yeah.
like we would change how it's regulated. Immigration just has a lot of like other equities, right?
I don't know. I think that,
and to the point, yeah. I mean, to the point of the whole conversation about oligarchy, right?
Yeah.
Part of the difficulty.
The real oligarchy.
Well, no, it's like
the gerontocracy.
Part of the difficulty you have persuading people about this is that, you know, the benefit here is of like expanded supply of low wage workers. But that's like also an argument that's leveled against immigration all the time, right? And so, you know, you've got to tell people, right? This whole idea, separate from people's concerns about cultural change of immigration, is like you have to convince people that like the labor market is a positive sum experience, right? And that like it's not a zero sum scramble against billionaires, because you're saying here, right? Like you are going to extra material resources are going to flow to America's elderly.
Yeah.
And that the mechanism through which that's going to happen is like international labor migration, driving down the cost of employing home health aides.
Yeah.
And that's just like a very different world from a world in which we have to fight the oligarchy.
But I mean, I do think, though, that like this speaks to, I mean, we had a podcast recently that I thought I really enjoyed about the asylum. And one thing that Matt and I, you know, despite disagreeing a lot on that podcast, one thing we really agreed on is this idea of understanding immigration as something that should be in the national interest. And I do think that, like, there are lots of people who, like, do not understand and are not even there's not even an attempt to convince them about how much immigration is actually in their direct interest. Like, this happened, lots of the time immigration activism and discussion is about, look how amazing these immigrants are. America is a nation of immigrants. You should support it. You're a bigot. Maybe if you don't support immigration, look at the unjust things that they're fleeing. Do you really want to stop these children from, like, it is very focused on either like almost like a charitable mindset that you're trying to tap into, or, you are a bad person for having qualms about this. And I think in general, like, there's not actually a lot of this sort of thing where it's like, literally, you will be better off. You personally will have these better outcomes in your life if you are willing to accept immigration. But I think on top of that, there's like a focus on, I think about this a lot when it comes to the like YIMBYism, like early stage YIMBYism often really did focus on like desegregation, or focusing on the idea that there were this, as we talked about earlier, a cabal of homeowners that were blocking change that was necessary in order to produce
oligarchy.
Yeah, to produce housing abundance. But like AARP got on board with a bunch of like zoning reforms because they recognize that there's like self-interest here. And I think that like the successful YIMBY coalitions have been ones that are like, actually, you can just make this argument for libertarians, for right-wingers, for progressives, for like basically anyone, because housing supply is just like a universal human need. And so I don't know, like I really like this paper because I think it's actually just like straightforwardly useful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question, you know, ultimately is if you want, you know, because there's two different ways in which this sort of comes up, right? And I think back, I don't know, 15 years ago, like classic immigration debate was, there's all these people who've immigrated here illegally, you know, mostly from Mexico, mostly like sneaking across the border explicitly to work. And the question was like, how freaked out about that should we be? And a lot of people, you know, Tom Tancredo and others at the time when I was new, they were saying like, we should be like really freaked out about this. This should be like a first order, like concern of ours. Too many people have snuck across the border and they're working here legally. And I was really into, I mean, this paper wasn't out at that time, but like this kind of thing that was like, this is actually not that big of a problem. You know, it's like not ideal. Obviously, nobody's like going to say my vision of immigration is a lot of people should sneak across the border and work for cash under the table. Mm-hmm. But I was saying like, it's actually kind of fine. Like, there's a lot of upside to this sort of thing. As the immigration debate has evolved since then, it's like actually the dovish position has landed more on defending specific legal structures. And then it raises the question when it connects to the economics literature of, well, are the structures like matched well mm-hmm. to like actually maximize these benefits? And the answer is no, in much the case that like the old system also wasn't.
Okay.
And so it's like, well, as we keep having this debate and as the pro-immigration side, I think, has like mostly been losing ground. Right. It's like, can we refocus on these questions of like actual advantages? But that means giving ground on like debate points that don't like relate specifically to this kind of thing.
I'm going to refrain from turning this into another 40-minute pod about immigration, because I do want to ask you about like the AI thing, because I do think this is something that's me and you've both been kind of worried about. I mean, the big benefit of immigration is expanded labor supply, whether it's the high-skilled immigration or like just the broad entry of new workers, both in their ability to like, you know, do different various jobs, but also to specifically plug up areas where there are quote unquote shortages. Like, we just want more construction workers, and in the short term, it's hard to like make them domestically. And AI kind of undercuts some of this. Like, if AI can just actually do tons of labor without humans, you just need fewer humans to achieve economic growth. I think that like care and places where people really do want human touch, yes, cheaper AI options could take over for some people, but like, I think most people don't view that as like a good thing. And you're going to see a bunch of protectionism against this. So you're going to see situations where, no, you are not allowed to have AI robots unsupervised. You need like a ratio of like AI robots to humans watching grandpa and grandma in the nursing homes, or like conversely for very young children too. People are gonna be very uncomfortable with the idea of like no human beings raising small kids. But like, it sounded like you were skeptical of this idea earlier.
I mean, it's trippy to even think about. I mean, I wrote a piece about this. Like, I find it increasingly difficult to write like honestly and coherently about like any public policy issue, because it ends up converging on like these sort of speculative questions about AI, you know? So it's like, I'm just like turning off my AI brain and I'm thinking about the like evolution of the immigration policy debate since 2005 or mm-hmm. so, and like labor markets and 1 billion Americans and aging of society, and like really like what I think we should have is more temporary guest workers to fill in these kind of things. But people keep calling this a doomer take, but I am like not a doomer. I am bullish on the power of artificial intelligence to come up with humanoid robots.
That is a doomer take.
Address a lot of these concerns. And like, my best guess, although I'm not like 99% credence on this, but like I think above 50% is that in the relatively short term, we are going to see a real relaxation of human labor as the constraining quality. Some of that won't be because robots are directly displacing care work. It's going to be because robots are displacing people from, you know, like office-y jobs. And then those people are going to say, well, like, what is,
gotta
it,
do
that,
care work,
what is it that I can do? But some of it is that like robots are going to have advantages, right? Because like one problem, one downside to relying on immigrants to do this sort of thing is that elderly people benefit from like people they can talk to, right? And, you know, it's like somebody doesn't speak your language and you can't do that. One thing AI is really good at is like not losing patience with your bullshit, you know, and like having really long, in-depth conversations about whatever it is you want to talk about, whatever it is you're interested in. And I think that like elderly people will find that aspect of AI to be like really powerful, and actually, frankly, not just elderly people, you know, that like this is going to be a boon in a lot of these kinds of roles, but is also going to, you know, diminish. I don't know. Like it's I think the interaction of like immigration, labor market economics, AI is like a really tricky topic because I don't think that it's in bad faith that progressive minded people talk about the economic benefits of immigration. But it's not like you would be saying, oh, fuck these people, if like you read a different paper about labor market economics. Like you have a true cosmopolitan ethos and like you care about the well-being of people born in the Philippines. So you're like glad that there's this good evidence that they're saving the lives of elderly people.
Yeah, I'm glad when reality you know, correlates with my worldview.
Well, and not just when it correlates with your worldview, right? But like specifically, like if like cranky old people who don't like immigrants could see direct benefits to them, right, that could really like unlock political change, right? And so it's like the world might just change in an inconvenient way for people who have even back to Bernie and the oligarchy, right? He was saying the other day that the government should own 50% of the AI labs, and that's because, you know, they stand on the backs of like the entirety of human knowledge. But so it's like, why should, if you accept the moral reasoning of that argument, why should the American government own 50% of the labs, right? Now, obviously, part of the answer is like politics, right? Like the nationalizing AI labs is like a heavy lift. Nationalizing AI labs on behalf of Nigeria is like, that's like really not going to happen. So I get why the bill is written the way that it is, but like cosmopolitanism and democracy are in some tension, and I think like a bigger tension than oligarchy and
I think
and
this
democracy.
Is true, but only to the extent that cosmopolitanism doesn't result in high economic growth. And like this is exactly what we're talking about with AI, but like most cosmopolitan views are like, you know, pro free trade, pro free movement of people, like those things are what are the bedrock of economic growth, which is, to be clear, like most people want economic growth. It's like a positive thing.
But
I think AI, you're right, like does interact with this in ways where really unknown. And then it becomes a problem of like, okay, well, like, is everyone in the world who doesn't live in a country where you can tax AI labs basically just like fucked forever? And we try to usually use peer review to end in a more positive way, but that is kind of my fear.
Yeah.
Well, for positive conversations like these, subscribe to The Argument.
You know, also, like, share it with your friends.
Please,
you know,
yes.
Like it. We're not in a zero-sum podcasting universe. You know, no. We've got to share the wealth.
Exactly.
Fight the oligarchy, you know.
We're fight the oligarchy.
Here,
subscribe to The Argument.
Yeoman podcasters.
Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No.